Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar.
This is Mike Pinzak in the KBO newsroom. MetEd company officials had to shut down their Three Mile Island nuclear power station unit number 2 this morning after an accident occurred within the plant's turbine system. Officials have been saying that there is no danger to the general public and that the situation is under control.
That was WKBO's Mike Pintek providing the first media report of the accident at Three Mile Island. For the 40th anniversary of the partial meltdown at TMI on March 28, 1979, WITF is collaborating with PA Post and Penn Live on a multimedia month-long look at the accident, its impact, and the future of TMI in the nuclear industry. That includes new documentary television and radio programs, long-form audio stories, photos, and digital videos. The work will include the voices of people affected as well as community events to engage with listeners, readers, and viewers. You can follow our overall coverage all month long on air and online at papost.org. Joining us throughout the program today, we're actually going to have several people who are joining us on the phone, but here in the studio is WITF State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Marie Cusick. Marie, always good to have you on the program.
Great to be here, Scott.
And WITF producer Mike Williams. Mike, your very first appearance on Smart Talk.
It is.
I don't know how we avoided having you on the show over the years. You've worked on so many projects.
I like being behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes. But Mike Williams is on the scenes today telling us about some of the work that he's doing on Three Mile Island. Now, also coming up in the next hour, we will be talking with a journalist who worked here in Harrisburg during that time period in 1979, telling a few stories of what happened at TMI and especially the aftermath, the 5 days especially after the accident itself. We will hear from Eric Epstein, who is a longtime chairman of the group TMI Alert. And we'll hear from a teacher. She taught first grade in the Middletown School District in 1979. Her class, her first graders, wrote letters to Harold Denton of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the story gets, there's a little bit more to it than just writing letters, first graders writing letters to the NRC, and we'll get to hear that story as well. And I will say this, we will take your stories today. We're already taking a lot of stories, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but we'd like to hear your stories from that period, March 28th, 1979. Where were you when you found out about TMI? What did you do over the next few days? Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And we will try to get to as many on the phone as we can, but we will encourage you to send emails to email your stories. Mike Williams, I want to start with you because right up front, before we get into some of the things that that did happen in 1979, the project that you're working on involves collecting these stories. Before we even get started with the stories themselves, how can our listeners do that, WITF listeners do that?
Well, we're building a website right now. It's not quite ready yet. So the easy thing to do is it's as simple as an email. Just email your story. If you have photos, you can send them also to tmi@witf.org. We'll have the website up very soon, but right now we're collecting stories to build that website. We have about 150 already, and we're looking for a lot more. So if you have a story, email it to tmi@witf.org.
So, as you said, Mike, we've already received about 150 stories. What are some of the stories that stick out to you, or are there any themes or consistencies in the stories that you're seeing so far?
We've had stories from just about every different angle that you can imagine. You know, some people were deeply involved with political ends of things. Some people worked at the plant, but we also want to get just the public because that's the majority of who was affected. 950,000 people lived in the area at the time. That's a lot of stories. We've had everything from the teachers to kids who are in class. One individual, or actually a couple individuals, said, you know, they're sitting in class. They're kids. It's the 70s. You don't listen to the radio in the morning. They don't know
they
anything
should,
going
except
on.
When there's a snow day, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So they're just in class, and their classmates are disappearing one by one. The parents had been hearing about this. They're coming to pick up the schools. But, the you know, little Johnny sitting in English class doesn't know why he's one of five kids left out of 30 at the end of the school day. And then when he gets on the bus at the end of the day, the bus driver says, don't put down the windows. and, you know, no talking. And it's kind of a scary time. It was a very scary time for a lot of people.
You know, that first day, and actually the first couple of days, but the first day especially, March 28th, I have heard from so many people, some of the stories, obscene stories that Mike is talking about, but people that we've interviewed who said that the first reaction from schools, from institutions where they worked, was to close the windows, close the doors, don't go outside. Like somehow this was going to keep them from being exposed to radiation if there was a radiation release. And it just goes to show that people living in this region knew so little about what was going on and how you actually do so. What it reminded me of was the 1950s when, you know, there were the drills where the students were told to hide under the desk if there was a nuclear bomb had been dropped. I mean, that's the comparison I make.
Exactly. There was, some of the kids found out because the principal ran in their schoolroom and started closing the windows and closing the curtains. And then, you know, later in the day, these kids that were behind closed curtains and behind closed windows and get on the bus, well, they said, you know, as soon as I get to my bus stop, they said, okay, get out. It's like, wait a minute. You had me inside all day telling me about the worries of radiation. And then as soon as I get to my bus stop, it's like, all right, good luck.
You're on your own now, yeah. Well, I mentioned in the introduction that WITF is producing two half-hour documentaries. One that I'm producing has to do with the actual history of what happened at TMI on March 28th, and then the few days after, leading up to, and we kind of wrap it up, and I talk about the cleanup a little bit, and talk about some of the findings, the health findings over the years. But for the most part, it focuses on those 5 days, what actually happened inside the plant, and to that Sunday when President Jimmy Carter visited Central Pennsylvania, visited TMI. One of the things that I've learned, living here for the last 40 years in Central Pennsylvania, didn't realize it as much at the time, but how much Jimmy Carter coming to Central Pennsylvania and visiting TMI, how much that meant to the people of Central Pennsylvania, because many people thought, oh, if the president finds it safe enough to come to the plant, wear those booties. There's that classic picture of President Carter wearing booties to protect against radioactive water in the plant, that it must be safe. Okay, if we've left, we can come back. So that is one thing. So, you know, I start when we talk about the documentary, which is still in the works, start with what happened. It was a simple plumbing problem. That, you know, there was a valve that got stuck, and then there was some human error that the operators in the control room didn't recognize what they saw, and eventually the core, the radioactive core, was exposed, and there was a partial meltdown. Didn't know that there was a partial meltdown until a few years later, but all this is going on. What a lot of people knew about it at the time had come from the movie The China Syndrome, which had been released just 2 weeks earlier. And the premise of that movie was that there was a nuclear meltdown. If there would have been a nuclear meltdown, that it would have gone through the containment building and made, and there was an iconic line in there that said, made an area the size of Pennsylvania uninhabitable for decades to come. So that's one of the things you can look forward to with the first documentary. The second brings us up to today. And nuclear power itself has, it's been in the news a lot lately, and Marie Cusick, and Marie has been on our program many times, reports for State Impact Pennsylvania, which reports on Pennsylvania's energy economy. Marie is producing documentary looking at nuclear power today and just where it goes. How would you describe the documentary, Marie?
Well, we are taking a look at the present day. As you mentioned, it's a really interesting time because almost exactly 40 years after this major accident, the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history, the nuclear industry is coming to Harrisburg and saying, hey, please, we need help to keep these plants online. There are 5 nuclear power plants in Pennsylvania right now. 2 of them are scheduled to close prematurely before their operating licenses expire, including TMI. So it's just a really strange time right now because the nuclear industry is coming to the state saying we need help. They've already done this successfully in some other states where uneconomic plants were propped up by the states. So
I've had State Senator Ryan Aumed from Lancaster County, who is the chair of this nuclear power legislative group in the legislature. We have actually hear from him about some legislation that's come. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yeah, they're actually, he and another legislator are expected as early as next week to propose a bill that's been in the works for years, really. They've been meeting for years, 2 years, about this and trying to figure out what to do to keep these plants online. And what they're looking to do is they're looking to amend a 2004 law known as the Alternative Energy Portfolio Standard. And that requires electric companies to purchase a certain portion of their power from clean and alternative sources. And right now, that list does not include nuclear, so they want to change that.
Does that lead into...
Yeah, that's what he's talking about.
This is Senator Aumed.
The public policy goal was to allow for alternative energies and reduce carbon emissions. I think it was really, frankly, an oversight at that time that nuclear energy was not included because of the important environmental carbon-free benefits. And so we see this, the proposal that we're offering, really as a correction.
So just to clarify a few things, there is some irony in that it's 40 years after the accident. This has nothing to do with the accident. I mean, today, the people who are supporting this are talking about nuclear being safe, being clean, that at a time when we're talking about climate change, that nuclear should be part of that, as well as the other renewable energies.
Well, I think on some level it does have something to do with the accident, because when you ask people to support nuclear power, you need that social license to operate. Do people feel comfortable with it? Because we've seen in the U.S., obviously, except for this accident, it's been run very safely, but we've seen elsewhere in the world, Chernobyl, Fukushima, when something goes wrong at a nuclear power plant, it can go very wrong. Do people feel comfortable with it? And right now, the new real environmental crisis that the world is dealing with is climate change. So you have, again, the nuclear industry saying, hey, look, these plants, it's water vapor coming out of the cooling towers. It's not carbon emissions. We need to keep these resources online if we have any hope of addressing climate change. So that's been a powerful argument that they've made successfully elsewhere. The difference here in Pennsylvania, I think, and we'll see what happens. It's going to be a big debate in the next few months when these bills come out. But we have a very powerful natural gas industry, and they've been growing their share of electric power generation. They've been building new natural gas plants. So they are actually lobbying very aggressively against this and saying they've created a group called Citizens Against Nuclear Bailouts. So we'll see what happens. But I think you can't separate the accident from today's discussion, because, you know, it really comes down to, does the public feel comfortable enough with nuclear energy to keep helping these plants and supporting them?
Marie, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to WITF Smart Talk. We're going to be talking with a journalist who covered the TMI accident and the aftermath in just a few minutes. First, we're joined by WITF producer Mike Williams, who's been collecting stories from listeners or people who lived in central Pennsylvania or were impacted by the accident at Three Mile Island in 1979. We're going to hear a couple of those stories in just a moment. What we're doing, if you're just tuning in, WITF has collaborated with PA Post and Penn Live. This is a big project. I mean, this is one of the most historic events in central Pennsylvania. Over the next month, we will be producing a lot of stories, a lot of different media, TV, documentaries, radio documentaries, audio, photos, digital videos, all those things coming up over the next month or so. Today is day one. There will be a TMI story almost every day during the month of March, leading up to March 28th, the actual 40th anniversary of the accident at Three Mile Island. Before we get to our journalist here in just a moment, Mike Williams, I want to give an example of some of the things that you've heard, a collection of the stories. And this is a good example of what a lot of people have gone through. Kind of set this up for us, if you would.
Well, as the accident happened on a Wednesday morning.
Right.
And as the Pintech story got out, the story got bigger and bigger. But people didn't really know what to do. What, you know, there's an accident there. Half the stories were, there's no radiation release. You're fine. We got it under control. But the public start worrying about this. You know, what am I supposed to take an action? And they really didn't know until Friday. So between Wednesday and midday Friday, when the governor finally said to the effect of, if you have a pregnant woman or a child in your family, perhaps you ought to leave a 5-10 mile radius. Between Wednesday and Friday, it was up to the individual to figure out, what should we do? Should we stay? Should we go? Are we safe? Are we not? And the only thing you could do is wait for the noon news report, wait for the 6 and the 11, read the paper, and ask your neighbors and maybe someone worked at TMI. Kip Adams was one of the people that we had talked to. He lived in just south of the Holtwood Dam on the Susquehanna River, right in between two nuclear power plants, you know, just south of TMI. And he described what it was like for him to make that decision to leave. I should preface it by saying Kip had, his son was born that morning, Wednesday morning. He found out as he's taking care of his newborn son when a TMI employee that he knew walked up and said, hey, did you hear what happened at the plant?
What really motivated us to finally leave was 2 days after the accident, that Friday, Governor Thornburgh had declared an evacuation of a 5-mile radius for pregnant women and young children from the plant, a 5-mile radius from the plant. And I thought to myself and told my wife that, you know, this is really bad. This is serious. That was an indication where if the government is now telling people, you know, a certain segment of the population to evacuate, then this could be a whole lot worse than what we even suspect.
So I think that Kip Adams' story, he has the kind of he had a kind of thought process that a lot of people had. And plus, he had the fact, as you said, a newborn baby not knowing what to do.
Exactly. And you're worried about your family. You're worried about everything minute to minute. One of the things that Kip also touched on, which a lot of people reflected through the stories that we've talked about so far, is, okay, you decide that you're going to leave. Well, this is not leaving for vacation. You could be leaving forever. And that was a reality. Some people grasped that right away. Some people, once they hit the road, they went, whoa, if something big happens, if that plant goes belly up, or the China syndrome thing where Pennsylvania is rendered uninhabitable for decades to come, we may never come home again. And that was a, well, Kip describes it better than I can.
The real fear set in on our way when we finally decided to make that evacuation. And this is I think, one of the most profound points of the whole experience was, while we were en route to my sister's, we had this very clear idea that if things got extremely bad, we would never be able to return home. Never be able to return home.
Wow.
It kind of hits you. One of the people that I was talking to just the other day said, yeah, I'm standing by in my car, the doors are open, and I'm trying to decide what to take from my house to put in the car if I never, ever come back again. So he was a CPA, so, you know, he was very decision maker. So he went, oh, I'll take 2 weeks of clothes. I have my bank account just in case I leave to another town. I have to prove for federal agencies that I do have money. I'll take my credit cards. If something big happens, I'll put money on the credit cards. If I can't pay those off, you know, worst case scenario, I'm not going to be worrying about the credit card bill.
You know, there, and again, a lot of people, we don't know the exact numbers, but many people who evacuated went to ATMs, Mac machines at that time, or to the bank and took money out because, again, not knowing whether they were going to come back or not. I want to turn now to the media coverage a little bit. Dave Sullenberger worked at as a radio journalist at WHP Radio in Harrisburg 40 years ago, and you probably recognize his name. He went on to work as a TV reporter at WHP TV. Dave Sullenberger, you're now in Indiana. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, good morning. Good to be here.
So let's go back 40 years, Dave. What do you remember about, first of all, that first day of the TMI accident working in a newsroom?
Well, the biggest takeaway I remember from it is just the gross uncertainty. I don't think that there was no evidence that the Dick Thornburg or Bill Scranton knew a whole lot more about nuclear power and radiation than we did as journalists or the public did. It was just the whole idea of what is this thing that suddenly we're supposed to be afraid of or concerned about. You know, you can see floodwaters, you can see smoke, you know, other disasters. You can kind of, but this radiation thing was a whole new concept for us in the newsroom, but also I think for the public officials who were trying to explain what was going on. It was just the idea of uncertainty of, you know, what are the facts, what are the radiation readings, who did what when, and just trying to get a handle on that was very difficult the first couple days.
And as a journalist, as you're covering this story, which is probably unlike any other that you had covered up until that time, as you said, not knowing as much as what even the governor did, the lieutenant governor, who was the head of PEMA, Bill Scranton, knew at the time, there was a lot of confusion then from information you were getting from Metropolitan Edison, which run the plant, General Public Utilities, which own the plant, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission a little bit later. But there was a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion. Describe that as a journalist, and as you're trying to put stories together, something that your audience is really, really wants to know what's going on.
Well, we had to rely on was the people, the government officials, the State Department of Environmental Resources. I'm not sure what they were called in that time, DPE or something. They had a couple people who were knowledgeable about radiation doses and how much was being measured a place. But we were really at the mercy of Jack Herbine and the Metropolitan Edison spokespeople, and since then it's been called a public relations disaster, in that they just did not have a really handle on exactly what was going on, what had happened. They were talking about radiation releases and whether they were going to continue, and they kept saying yes, they will continue. We measured them. We don't think they're a problem. They even went so far as to say we think the plant's going to be back in operation very shortly. They had no idea of the extent of the damage at that time, and all we could do was rely on the government officials who were trying to sort it out and tell us what we knew at that time. But there was just a lot of questions and a lot of vague, nebulous kind of evaluations of what had happened and what was going to continue to happen, because at this point they did not. This is even before this hydrogen bubble was determined, was found. They didn't know how much radiation was going to be released into the air, and it was just a lot of having to rely on people who either could not explain it in plain language or just didn't know what was going on.
Just for background purposes, it is absolutely true that Metropolitan Edison had no communications team at the time. They had no PR team to handle this. So Jack Herbine, that Dave mentioned, was a vice president, and MedEd put out a number of people who, they weren't skilled, they weren't trained to talk to the public, to talk to the media in plain English terms, put it that way, about what was going on at this nuclear plant. And the hydrogen bubble that Dave was referring to, that became a real issue, like, say, day three, where it was determined that there was a hydrogen bubble, highly radioactive, that was growing inside the plant, and that if it would have exploded, would have spewed, this was the theory, spewed radiation all over the area. Now, speaking of Jack Herbine, again, a MedEd president, here's something he had to say very early on one of the press conferences about the accident itself and how dangerous it was.
The nuclear industry has been telling you for years that this kind of an accident certainly is possible. It's possible to have fuel failure. What's not possible is the hypothetical accident that you hear about, where the entire core melts and spews molten radioactivity into the area for miles around and kills tens of thousands of people. That's what we've been telling you is not possible. What we've seen here is a fuel failure, something that's possible with an operating reactor today. And nobody's ever said that this couldn't happen. And the safety systems were designed to take care of this kind of an accident, as our safety systems did.
You're saying there's no China syndrome possibility at all, isn't that right?
I'm saying that we don't have any China syndrome possibility with the events that occurred at Three Mile Island over the past 2 days.
So China syndrome, again, a reference to the movie that a meltdown would go through the containment building, the concrete containment building, melt into the ground, spewed radiation everywhere. And that, although I guess if you're going to be technical about it, that was true, that there was not a complete meltdown, so no radiation was spewed into the atmosphere. There was a partial meltdown, though, and there was some radiation released off-site. So, Dave, let me go back to you. Jack Irvine was the main spokesman the first few days. Did you, as a journalist, get a sense that what he was saying was hard to understand, hard for reporters to comprehend, even hard for the people who were in elected office to understand?
Oh, absolutely. He was, like you say, he was not a public relations trained speaker. He was he would talk about radiation doses and millirems, and at that point, people did not know what the unit of measurement was. They would say it's the same as a chest X-ray or normal background readings. And the thing that concerned people earlier the most was how much radiation was released and what damage does it do to the human body. And he was very, very uncertain as to how much was being released and when it was going to continue to be released and whether they were measuring it at a certain place, where they were measuring it. And he got a lot of questions about that issue of how much radiation has been released and what's the effect of that. And that was not his area of expertise. So there was, it was a long time until only when Harold Denton showed up later on did someone come up who could really talk in plain language and compare and describe what was happening in language that journalists could understand and the public could understand.
Harold Denton, from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who Governor Thornburg asked President Carter to send someone who could sort out all the chaos and all the overlapping stories and conflicting stories. And many people point to Harold Denton as really one of the heroes of this because he was able to put it in plain language and explain what was going on.
Yes, he was. He was very helpful, and I think if there's anyone who restored calm and some kind of sense of stability to the whole situation, it was Harold Denton from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
So, Dave, when you look back on that time period, what are your first thoughts? What do you think about?
Well, it was just that whole question of what is this stuff that's coming out of this plant. It was at the beginning. It was not so much what could happen in terms of explosion or meltdown. It was mostly just the effects of radiation. And we kept. You know, I think a lot of journalists were wondering: are we sacrificing our health in order to stay here and explain what was going on to the people? And we thought, well, if that's the case, that's certainly a noble cause. But it was just the whole notion of who Ernest Sternglass from the Union of Concerned Scientists was saying every dose of radiation is an overdose, and then Jack Irvine was saying this is not the amount of radiation which we've monitored different places is not enough to cause harm. Mm. And so you had these conflicting evaluations of what's the effect of the releases, which they acknowledged were happening and would continue to happen all week long.
Dave Sullenberger was with WHP Radio at the time in 1979, went on to work for WHP-TV. Hey, Dave, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. You're in Indiana, but thank you very much for sharing your memories of Three Mile Island.
No problem. Thank you.
I want to bring in one of our callers now. Let's see. We have Daphne from Camp Hill. Daphne, understand that you were pregnant at the time during the accident, correct?
Waiting 40 years to tell the story. I was 7 months pregnant. It was a beautiful, warm, sunny day, and I was out front admiring my little crocuses, and I guess the daffodils were open by then. So I was enjoying myself, and then my husband, who worked downtown, calls, and he says, "Did you hear what happened?" And all this, and I forget all the details, he said. And I said, "Oh, my God, no, I haven't heard anything." And I was listening to WITF all morning because
well,
they
that's
were
good.
Playing music in those days. So I come in, and I don't know, I guess I closed the windows. And then I called WITF. I said, "How come you didn't announce anything?" and I'm outside and I'm pregnant. And she said, what's going on? And she was so shocked. So I don't know what time the man made the announcement, but it was after that. I think it was about 11 o'clock or 11:30 or I don't know. It was morning. So, and then I was pregnant. My sister in York had a child, a little one. And so they were calling me to take them to New Jersey where we had cousins. So we went to New Jersey, and I had no idea what this was, the danger of this. I just kind of took it with a chuckle, and I was thinking, gee, if we come back in 100 years, my roses will have grown up into the tree, you know, like Sleeping Beauty.
Well, Daphne, I encourage you to send your story to WITF.org, and, because we are collecting them, have about 150, 175 of them now, but we're collecting many more, and these will be here forever for Central Pennsylvania and people outside of Central Pennsylvania to learn about and to hear. Daphne, thank you very much for calling in. We're going to be talking with Eric Epstein from TMI Alert in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
A general emergency has been declared at the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Plant near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The plant is operated by Metropolitan Edison Company. MetEd officials say that a water pump used to cool the reactor broke down. Residents near the plant have not been evacuated, but MetEd official Blaine Fabian says that some radiated steam escaped into the atmosphere before the building could be sealed. Fabian says the radiation level was not higher than normal and not considered dangerous to health. No injuries have been reported. Michelle Lefevre, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
And that was Michelle Lefevre, who worked for WKBO in Harrisburg at the time. And that was an Associated Press report that went out nationally. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about WITF's coverage of the Three Mile Island accident 40 years later. We'll be providing a lot of coverage over many media here at WITF. There will be two television documentaries, radio documentaries, radio stories, also long-form audio stories, photos, digital video. This is a collaboration between WITF, PA Post, and Penn Live. If you want to see our coverage all month, you can go online at papost.org to learn more about it. We are taking a few more of your stories as well. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to bring in Eric Epstein now. Now, Eric has probably been the most vocal voice related to TMI over the last 40 years. He's chair of the group TMI Alert. Eric, always good to have you on the program.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be here, man.
40 years later. Now, you actually weren't here. You were going to school when the accident itself occurred. But as I said, you probably have been out front on this issue more than anyone. Over the last 40 years, your thoughts on what occurred on March 28, 1979, and what has occurred since?
Well, I think it was a stunning moment in history. You know, nobody was really prepared for an accident of that magnitude. If folks recall, there was no 24/7, 365 news cycle. So information that was parsed out wound up being inaccurate and misleading by the company. We had a situation where the lieutenant governor on Thursday, March 29th, basically had to confess to the public that the information they were getting for the utility was unreliable. And I think what really kind of amped up the psychic background, terror in the background, was the fact that a lot of people forget this, the China Syndrome had just been released 3 weeks earlier. So we didn't really have environmental reporters, Ben, science reporters. So a lot of folks, in order to achieve some kind of baseline on nuclear power, actually went to see the movie The China Syndrome. And, you know, I think it was a turning point in terms of how we discuss nuclear power, not only in this country, but around the world. Prior to that time, we all accepted nuclear as a somewhat magic panacea to our dependence on Arab oil. We just had two oil embargoes in the 70s. So information coming out was confused. People really didn't know how to interpret it. I think folks would acknowledge at the plant, as they've done after the accident, that essentially filters went off stack. Monitors became clogged. And You know, Scott, we really didn't know how much radiation escaped. In fact, we didn't know the full condition of the core until 84. So, you know, I would say it's an accident without an end. I mean, obviously, the bookend at the beginning was horrific, and in my mind, a form of psychological terror, because people don't know if they're coming home. They don't know what they're running from. They don't know where they're going or how long they're going to stay. But on top of that, people, I think, have lost track of the fact that TMI-2 was not cleaned up. It was defueled. At the time the plant was built, there was no decommissioning funding. So for the last 40 years, we've been trying to have TMI-2 cleaned up. Now, the plant itself, it was built for $700 million, was 5 years behind schedule and 2.5 times over budget. We did agree to help bail out TMI-2 in 81 when Governor Thornburg, if you recall, was the governor at the time, to help defuel TMI-2. And then we got the bill for the cleanup of TMI-2, but the actual plant and the cost to clean up the plant is $1.2 billion. So, you know, if you look at where we were back then to where we are now, I think there's a larger information base. I think the community is better informed. Obviously, we're having a discussion about nuclear now and bailouts. So it's an issue that has interest within the community. But from a media perspective, up until 85, when the plant restarted, that's Unit 1, not Unit 2, TMI had a dedicated reporter at the Patriot. There was a story every day. We were at the point where weather conditions actually included radiation releases at TMI. So there's been a titanic shift about how focused we are on TMI, but I think there's intense interest in the future of nuclear power now as there was then.
So, as I said, TMI Alert existed before the accident in 1979. Would you say that TMI Alert was an anti-nuclear group?
I think you got to remember, I think that's what we were perceived as being. You know, we prefer the mantle of safe energy because one of the things we do at TMI Alert is not what we're against, but what we're for. And we've been for a balanced energy portfolio since 77. We've actually finally achieved it. When we were formed, 92% of the electric in Pennsylvania came from coal and nuclear. Now, that's only down to 74%, but we're a solution-based organization. We've offered solutions for radioactive waste isolation. We believe it should be stored above ground, monitored, and something we're going to have to keep an eye on forever. But in terms of nuclear power, it's very clear to us that nuclear power is an economic fiction. It relies on government subsidies. It is corporate socialism. We've said that since 77. We'll say it now. The risk is publicized and the profit is basically goes to the corporation. So we don't think that's a sound economic model. We also recognize that TMI is the only uneconomical plant in the state. And the reality is that Peach Bottom, which is profitable, Limerick, which is profitable, Susquehanna, which is profitable, Beaver Valley, which is profitable, are probably going to operate, Scott, for another 20 years. So when you say anti-nuclear, we're realistic enough to know we're not going to shut the plant down. And every agreement that we've negotiated with the owners of Three Mile Island has had protections for workers, has had protection for the tax base, and has protection for charitable groups. So we're one of those groups that, we're safe energy, but we're pro-community. And I think it's a debate, Scott, that's going to rage on for a while because these plants are old. We're talking about plants that were built in the 60s technology, 70s dollars, and now we're facing what we always feared. How are we going to clean these plants up? Who's going to pay for them? And the age-old question, where's the waste going to go? You can call us anti-nuclear if you think having radioactive waste stored on an island in a river that feeds into the Chesapeake Bay, not a good idea. We believe that, but we have to be solution-based. And even if TMI shuts, we're going to have to monitor the plant, find a solution, and make an economic transition.
Eric Epstein is with TMI Alert. So much to talk about over the next month or so, Eric, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Scott, thanks for having me on. And by the way, drive safely. It looks like it's a little slick out there.
All right. Thank you very much. Eric, always with a little bit of extra advice there. But something that Eric did mention that we've received several emails during this program about, and that is the waste. Nuclear waste is still being stored on Three Mile Island. In the early days after the accident, a lot of the spent fuel and a lot of the waste was being shipped elsewhere. Richland Washington was a favorite spot where it went. There was controversy at the time about actually how it would be transported, whether by rail, by trucks. But think about that. There's an accident on the road with a truck, a train that derails. Those were a lot of things that people were concerned about, and rightfully so. And you know, some of the trains that went through these towns, the towns that they went through, was like, hey, we don't want that coming through our town. So as a result, since 1985, at least, probably all waste at Three Mile Island has been stored there in on Three Mile Island, the island itself, as Eric said, in the middle of the Susquehanna River. And that is an issue that will have to be dealt with some way, whether it's TMI or any other nuclear plant across the country. Wanted to talk now with Beth Surface. She was known as Beth Wolf at the time in 1979. Beth Surface was a first grade teacher at Kunkel Elementary School in the Middletown School District. Ms. Surface, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Well, okay, take us back to 1979. I mentioned that you were a teacher at Kunkel Elementary School, first grade teacher. Tell me about the accident. What happened March 28th? What you noticed around school? You know, were students leaving? Just what happened at that time?
Well, the day started as a regular day. It was a beautiful, as other people have said, it was a beautiful sunny day. Fairly early in the morning, we started having parents coming in who, it was obvious their anxiety level was raised, and they knew very little about what was happening, but their husbands worked on the island and they had received calls from their husbands asking them to go and get the children and to leave the area. So as the day went on, we had many more children who were being picked up. We didn't have any answers for the children. We did the best we could. We knew that we had to keep them indoors, keep the windows closed. They weren't allowed out for recess. At one point, we were told that the children would probably be organized into groups and taken to Wilson High School in Reading area. We were told to try and call our families so that our families would know that we'd be going into the Reading area later in the day. So it was basically organized chaos. As one of your callers indicated, there was nothing to see, there was nothing to smell. So I think that that's what allowed the staff to realize maybe this isn't as bad as they're saying, because we didn't see the threat. But my concern leaving that day was for my children, the way they had been picked up by parents who were very anxious. Other children saw the anxiety, and when we left that day, my biggest concern was, when would we be back together? What would these children remember from that day? How would I create closure for them and then move on?
All right. So the school classes were canceled for most of the schools in the area over the next week or so. I'm going to jump ahead. There's a lot to jump ahead. You know, we're missing during those 10 days. But I want to jump ahead because your class did something that was unique. The students came back to school. What did they do?
Well, we always gathered in a circle first thing in the morning. That was our tradition, and that's how our first day began. And it was really important to me, I can't stress that enough, that I could go back to that day and talk to them about, you know, how we left that day, where they went. I tried to keep it light, and not, you know, to make them fearful. I was really interested in knowing where they had been and to welcome them back to school and to the classroom. And the more they talked, the more I heard how Harold Denton was their hero. He was the gentleman who came and, in quotes, let the air out of the bubble. So as I listened to their memories of those 10 days and the things that they heard their parents talking about, it became clear that we should write a letter. In fact, they said we should write a letter to Mr. Denton. So we took a huge piece of experience paper, and we began writing the letter, and then they all signed it, and they did their own illustrations. And the interesting thing that Harold picked up on when he saw the letter was that with their names, they were drawing pictures of Easter bunnies and spring flowers. And he saw hope in that letter, and he wanted to meet the children. So that was our unique experience. When we were finished with the letter, I folded it, put it in a book bag of a child whose father worked on the island. I had no idea if the letter would actually ever reach Harold Denton, but indeed it did, and the rest was up to Harold.
So, okay, the rest is up to Harold. What did he do?
He tried to get in touch with us. Unfortunately, it was Easter weekend, and we had come back to school for a few days, and then we were off for the weekend for Easter. Simultaneously, all the major networks were attempting to be in touch with Harold so that they could do interviews with him, and he made the comment to someone that he wasn't interested in doing interviews, but if they could find the first grade teacher, he'd really appreciate it. Through contacts, friends of mine, someone at WGAL was able to contact me, and we then proceeded to set up a time when we could meet with Harold Denton, and over the course of the next month, all of my children had the opportunity to meet him, and what started out as a very anxious time for them ended up being a time of meeting a hero.
I mean, I don't know whether first graders think this way or not, but I mean, were there kids who thought, okay, this is the man that kind of saved my life? Or again, I don't know whether kids think that way or not.
I don't think that they thought in terms of dying. I really don't, because they were just 6 years old, 6 and 7 years old. What they knew was that he left the air out of the bubble. Now, what their understanding was of that bubble, I don't even know that they understood that, but they understood the anxiety of their parents. They understood the fact that they were taken from their homes. And one little boy who was being raised by his single mother, they went to a hotel. And it broke my heart to realize that he was in a hotel alone, away from his friends. This is what they understood of that time, that it was an unusual experience. They saw their parents in a different light, and they just wanted to go back to normal. And by Harold letting the air out of the bubble, they could begin to go back to normal. Mm.
Beth Surface was a first grade teacher at Kunkel Elementary School in Middletown at the time, Middletown School District. Great story, and we'll be hearing more about it over the next month or so. Ms. Surface, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
Thank you. So, Mike, I have to say that that is a great story. That is a great story,
absolutely.
But it brings home, you know, because a lot of the stories we've collected have come from people who were kids, who were students in school during the whole 1979 accident and the week after or so. And many of them had stories like that, not knowing what was going to happen.
Well, absolutely. If you think about it, it took place in 1979. So now we're asking everybody, hey, what do you remember? And the people that were of 40 to 50 years old now, most likely to write in and participate in this and send their emails to tmi@witf.org, are in that school age category.
We have one. You talked to someone by the name of Gretchen Hanrahan, and this kind of goes along the same lines of just what we were talking about parents.
Exactly. So Gretchen,
I just remember my parents being very stressed, and I remember thinking to myself that, wow, this is something I have not seen before, because when you're in the seventh grade, your parents have control of everything. And you know, the first time you kind of see them and know they're concerned or scared, that's when you really become concerned and scared.
So that kind of says it all.
Exactly. Yeah. From a kid's perspective, it's odorless, it's tasteless, it's invisible. What is this thing people are even talking about? But once you see the concern in your parents' eyes, that's when things became very real for a lot of people throughout Central PA.
Mike, we only have about 30 seconds left. Again, for those who didn't get on the air today and want to send in their stories, how can they do it?
The best way right now is send an email to tmi@witf.org. We are compiling those emails into a website. We're going to be launching that website probably within a week or so. It will be on air. It will be on social media. But for right now, TMI at WITF.org.
Mike Williams, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
WITF is collaborating with PA Post and Penn Live on this multimedia month-long look at the accident, its impact, and the future of TMI in the nuclear industry. It includes new documentary television, radio programs, long-form audio stories, photos, and digital videos. The work will include the voices of people affected as well as community events to engage with listeners, readers, and viewers. Follow our coverage all month long, on air and online at papost.org. Coming up on Monday Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about a new proposal out there that would have work requirements in order to receive food stamps.